Hello and welcome to the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 10th of December 2017. My name is Kelby Watson, and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Johnny Fox and Paul in London. We're now going to talk about Everybody's Talking About Jamie, which is on at the Apollo Theatre. It is a play about Jamie. Jamie New is 16, he lives on a council estate in Sheffield, he doesn't quite fit in, he's terrified about the future and he's going to be a sensation. This is based on a true story about a young man who has to decide, well, what he is, I suppose. It has book and lyrics by Tom McRae, music by Dan Gillespie-Sells, and is directed by Jonathan Butterill. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, it's based on the documentary, which I think was a BBC Three documentary. I hadn't seen the documentary when I saw the show, but I have actually subsequently seen the documentary. And it is actually very true. I mean, obviously, they've moved him from Durham to Sheffield, and there are a few other changes. But broadly speaking, it is actually the true story. It's written by a team that have not really done musicals before. So Dan Gillespie-Sells is a pop singer with a band called The Feeling, I think it is. And Tom McRae is more used to doing TV shows and other things, and films perhaps. And then even the director is perhaps fresher to the musicals. So I found that, frankly, a bit of a breath of fresh air, really, because it sort of feels very different to other musicals in that the score isn't kind of musicals by numbers. And I thought it was very fresh in that sense. I also think one of the big highlights of this show is Kate Prince's choreography, and she's more used to doing hip-hop and stuff like that. And it's particularly good in the school classroom scenes, which I thought they had an incredible energy and authenticity about them. And it's about this 16-year-old who wants to be a drag queen, and he wants also to wear a dress to the school prom, which is probably a bigger mountain to climb than being a drag queen. He lives with his mum. His mum's divorced from his dad. And his mum's very supportive. Her friend Ray, it's a female Ray, is also very supportive. And he's got a best friend called Pretty, who is actually a Muslim girl, who's also very supportive. So he's got a kind of supporting network around him. But his dad and his school and some of his classmates don't approve. So he's sort of his divided people around him, really. He goes to a shop to buy outfits, and that's run by a former drag queen, Hugo, as he's now owning the shop that is supplying outfits. And he starts developing an act before an invited audience because he's been kind of befriended by Hugo. And he goes on and does this one-off act, which gives him a lot of confidence. And then he then has to deal with the challenge of the prom. I just thought it was a very sort of life-affirming kind of play, really. I thought, as I said, the choreography was terrific. I liked the music very much. I liked the songs. And it's very enthusiastic, and it's a very happy cast. There was a kind of infectiousness about it. A lot of them had done the show in Sheffield where it started and have come with the show. And I think that even though they've only been together in London for a short while, it feels like they've been together a lot longer, which, of course, most of them have. One of the outstanding performances, me, was Lucy Shorthouse, who is this best friend, Pretty, who's kind of comfortable both with her Muslim culture, but also with Jamie's personal choices. I think that is a change from the documentary. I don't think that character was the same in the documentary. The relationship between Jamie and his mum is the heart of the play, and that's very important. And Josie Walker, I think, invests a lot of emotional energy into the part of Margaret, and she's got a big song in the second act, which is very moving. And then the very ballsy friend Ray is a lovely performance by Mina Anwar, who's kind of very loyal to both Jamie and to Jamie's mum. And then the boy, so John McRae towers over this with, you know, a very confident performance, a very passionate performance. I think it's a very impressive West End debut. Obviously, the show's message is tolerance, people being allowed to be who they are. And I think that comes over loud and clear, but not in a sort of sentimental way, you know, in a kind of defiant way, really. And I think it's clearly a very popular success. You know, the audience really liked it. It's been a very big critical success, which might perhaps be more of a surprise. I kind of hope it would be a commercial success, but I think that's yet to be seen. It's a niche audience, I guess, rather than a mainstream audience. But it's a very diverse audience, and I thought it was a very, very enjoyable evening, a breath of fresh air for the West End. And I really do hope it's a commercial success, because that will encourage more fresh air into the West End, which I think is, frankly, from a musical's point of view, just a bit stale, really. Everything's either a revival of a big Broadway show or Sondheim-esque in some way. And I think it's great to have something fresh and British like this. What did you think, John?
I also enjoyed it very much indeed. And all those things you said about how bright and infectious and a breath of fresh air it is, I absolutely endorse. I find it a bit of a curiosity that it came with such a massive reputation. I mean, right behind Hamilton, it must be the most anticipated and most hyped arrival in the West End for a long time. And yet it came from only 19 performances in Sheffield, and Nika Burns dashed up there on a day excursion to see a matinee and bought it more or less on the spot for London transfer. So what a stroke of wit and wisdom and genius to do that. So all hail to her. And initial audiences have responded extremely warmly to it. As you say, Gareth, that there could be, you know, maybe after the school holidays, Jamie won't be quite as popular as he once was, and it might quieten down a bit in January. But both the professional reviews and the word of mouth have all been very, very positive. So as you say, we're on that sort of council estate in Sheffield, peopled by mothers like Shannon Matthews' mother and portrayed by people like Sheridan Smith. And that's a nice, harsh background against which to grow up and come out gay at 16. I wondered whether the smoothing of Jamie's passage, so to speak, was a little bit tritely done, because he does have this very supportive entourage, including his understanding mother, rather unbullying classmates, apart from one handsome thug who's very easily taken down with a single smart remark, and this bunch of multicultural neighbours who are positively eager to roll out the red carpet and the rainbow flag. I have seen the BBC Three documentary, and in fact, the night I went to this production, the original Jamie Campbell was there. And there is definitely a romanticising and a glamorising and an extra layer of charm drafted onto the real story to make it into a musical, as you might expect. So for me, it was a bit like Kinky Boots, you know, based very, very loosely on a true story, but lurching rather far to the let's make everything glittery and glamorous and right at the end, rather than following a genuine narrative. But, you know, you could complain about that from everything from, I don't know, Annie to Finding Neverland. Always musicals tend to accentuate the positive. What I did think was very interesting, having done a little bit of research, is, as you say, Jamie arrives decorated with this album of tunes by the frontman of the group The Feeling, Dan Gillespie-Sells. And there's an element in this show that is very personal to him, because the character of Margaret, Jamie's mother, she has abandoned or been abandoned by her husband, who now wants nothing to do with her or with Jamie, and has adopted a new social friend in this lady called Ray, played by the TV comedian, comedy actress Mina Anwar, does it very well indeed. But there is just a suggestion that that's a lesbian relationship being formed between the mother and her friend. It's not actually referenced in the script, but it is a glance to real life. Dan Gillespie-Sells has an extraordinarily gender-fluid parenting. He was one of, I think, three siblings, and they were co-parented by his birth mother, her new partner, her new partner's male baby father, and I think someone else as well. It was a very, very unusual grouping of parents for that time. And I think he wanted to reflect it in the show. And I wonder whether it, because it's not explained in the show, some of the audience would go out into the night thinking, well, what was all that about? Completely agree with you that Kate Prince's choreography is fresh and sharp and great, and the teen actors playing all the teens are very, very fine. But for me, this production rested on two absolutely top of the class performances from John McRae, not just well observed as Jamie, but spectacularly well sung. His dancing is terrific. He owns the stage whenever he is in a number, but not at the expense of the rest of the company. It reminded me of the kind of debut that we saw in Charlie Stemp, when he completely owned half a sixpence and has become a star and gone on to something else. And I think this could happen for John McRae. And then Josie Walker playing his mother. She's wonderfully well observed. It's a very inviting performance, but the character is very sympathetic as well. But she has what I think is the only really heartfelt song in the show, called Here's My Boy, in the second act, with which she really does bring the house down. But when you talk about the songs, Gareth and I both said that we enjoyed them at the time, but I, apart from maybe Here's My Boy, I couldn't hum you one now. And I've got the song list in front of me, and I have no idea how Spotlight goes, or Work of Art, or Ugly in This Ugly World. I couldn't sing you any of them, even a snatch, which is wrong for a good musical. And the other thing that I felt about the material is that there's a certain, I'm trying to remember who Sondheim criticized. Oh, it was Charles Hart. That's right. Sondheim once said to Charles Hart when he submitted some work to him very early in his career, Sondheim sent it back and saying, the problem with you is you've got rhyming disease. And I wonder if the writers of Jamie have the same. You can feel a little bit of straining for rhyme in the lyrics. And I thought that was just took the shine off it slightly for me. But really, on one hearing of the album or one seeing of the show, you wouldn't pick that up. And I have a lot of hope for it. It might take a tiny little rewrite and perhaps come back in a different form on tour. But the staging is great. The band are wonderful. And I just feel it might be a little bit like Bend It Like Beckham, which I really liked, but then did not go on to be a complete commercial wow. And of course, with the Muslim girl who has ambitions, there is a little touch of Bend It Like Beckham about it. There's a touch of Blood Brothers as well, but never to the point of losing its own identity. And I found it a real shot in the arm to see a new British stage musical not derived from a movie or a back catalogue. So Godspeed, Jamie.
I don't think the London audience takes to British musicals that well, to be honest. No. And, you know, Bend It Like Beckham's a really good example of something that should have been hugely successful but wasn't. This might be another. Billy Elliot's the only one I can think of that's actually been a big commercial success. I mean, we might not agree, Blood Brothers. I'm not sure we'd agree on
5 years in the West End.
I'm not sure we'd agree on Made in Dagenham and Betty Blue Eyes, but I thought they were also very good British musicals.
Well, no, I do agree about Betty Blue Eyes. What I thought was wrong was that it was overcast for Central London. And when I saw it on tour in Ipswich, I think, with Hayden Oakley and I think Anna O'Byrne playing the leads, it was fantastic and much better appreciated. Yeah. But being done a little bit more intimately.
It's certainly true there's been less success with British musicals, I think, in the last, say, 10 years, with only, I mean, you know, Blood Brothers is a lot more than 10 years ago, but Billy Elliot is the only one that's commercially been successful, I think, in the last 10 years. The others have all lost money. So that's why I would like to see this a success, because I really want producers like Nicola Burns and others to be encouraged to bring stuff like this into the West End, because I do think it needs it. It needs that kind of injection, something fresh.
We're now going to talk about The Box of Delights at the Wilton's musical. This is a play by Piers Tourday based on the novel by John Masefield. It was adapted in the late 80s, I believe, with Patrick Troughton as the man who carries the Box of Delights and is hunted by people who can transform into wolves, which is rather fun. This production stars Matthew Kelly and Josefina Gabrielle. John, could you tell me more about this and what you thought of it?
I was very glad to go to this because I was quite distressed at missing last year's thigh-slapping panto at Wilton's, because I believe Roy Hudd's Mother Goose was absolutely a corker. So this year's seasonal offering is also an extravaganza with the sort of money that I would typically spend on a pantomime, but with a kind of shift towards the bleaker side of Christmas in the first ever stage adaptation of John Masefield's popular midwinter story, The Box of Delights. It's a dark tale of mystery and magic and folklore, and not one with which I was familiar because I think I was just the wrong age to catch that mid-80s television adaptation that you talked about. But in terms of atmospherics and mood and darkness and costume, and so you could argue it's a poor man's 1930s version of the Old Vic's Victorian choice of A Christmas Carol for the season. But at Wilton's, with a top price of £35, I think that's no bad thing. And, you know, it's nice to see an audience-pleasing show that means you can still afford to buy the kids Christmas presents, because if you take them to the panto at the Palladium or even to A Christmas Carol, you know, for a family, you're not going to get much change out of £600. Also, for younger audiences, the centering of the story on this kind of all-round good egg orphan schoolboy called Kay Harker, and the male and female cousins he meets up with at his guardian's for the Christmas holidays. It's just great for engagement. It brings in slightly older children, and it's hard to find a Christmas show that would amuse and entertain maybe 10 to 16 year olds, since a lot of pantomime is aimed at children younger than that. It's also interesting how similar these three kids are to Harry, Ron and Hermione. He's coming home from school on the train to someone who isn't his parents. And this is 50 years before Joanne Rowling dreamed up her banker. I think we should applaud productions that are brave enough to kick against the seasonal schmaltz. It's excitingly set. There are trapdoors in the floors, cupboards that open unexpectedly, a talking disembodied head and a really quite spectacular flood. So I think Tom Piper's stage set is the big draw. There's a series of video projections which are meant to enhance what's going on, but certainly from where I was sitting, they were diluted by the general lighting. And I think I've heard that from other people as well. But the other thing is that Wilton's natural acoustics really seem to surround and complement the choral interjections. And again, this is festive song, a little bit like a Christmas carol at the Old Vic is decorated with Christmas carols. These are not stage musical songs, and it's very unusual to see the wonderful Josefina Gabriel in a role or a pair of roles here that don't require her usual song and dance skills. But it's all about trickery and chicanery and duplicity and the contrast between the villains and this swashbuckling trio of brave cousins. And there's a healthy portion of mystery and adventure. And I think it's really good. And you know, I defy you not to laugh at a routine with the sequential sandbagging of a church choir until there's too few of them left to render We Three Kings. What you must say is it is an intensely woven narrative between the parallel storylines, the time travel, and the cast having to play multiple characters. Nearly everybody apart from the three kids is two people. It was impossible at times not to get slightly tied in knots. So I suspect that might be difficult for younger kids. So with a lack of tact, I patronised an adjacent seven-year-old in the interval to ask her how she was enjoying herself and whether she was following the story. She absolutely wiped the floor with me by reciting a perfect synopsis of what had happened and a pretty observant speculation of what might come in the second act. So it's not above the heads of children, although it made me think for a moment, Josefina Gabriel's plays one of the characters she plays, the deliciously vampish witch called Sylvia Pouncer. And one of her Miss Trunchbull-like lines is, "I don't approve of children being too clever." But really, I did approve of this little girl, and it was a delight that she got so much from this production. And the cast is very strong. Matthew Kelly is great, both as a sort of mysterious Punch and Judy man who propels the story and also plays his own dark nemesis in one moment with a kind of projected hologram of himself. And the trio of teens are just sustainedly good. You've got contrast within them. You have a young man more or less straight out of arts ed called Sam Simmons, who's a bookish, Blighton-esque lad called Peter, who really just wants to go back to his bedroom and avoid the drama. And then Safia Ingar playing Maria, who looks like a young Claudia Winkleman and really almost has the same kind of feisty, jokey persona as well. But then nice frame for Alistair Tovey's central character, which is this thoughtfully acted, thoughtfully drawn, kindly and brave Kay. And best thing for me in the entire show, it has a limbless dog. What more can you want? Paul, I think you were there. Tell me what you thought about it.
Yes, I was there. Although I would have said that, okay, Safia Ingar does have a resemblance to Claudia Winkleman, albeit one with Claudia Winkleman with better posture. But I think, you know, this is such a magical little show, actually. There was really evocative staging. I loved how they managed to use all the different levels of Wilton's Music Hall to such a great effect. And, you know, there were so many theatrical tricks they played, including a rather impressive flood, which actually looked terrific, even being so up close to all the action. You know, I think you're right, though, too. On the first half, I was thinking, oh, God, I don't know how young people can follow this story, because it's actually quite dense at times. But actually, as you said, the little girl two over from you, she could follow it perfectly. So maybe it's a plot that older people might have struggled to follow rather than the younger ones, because they're much more adept at, you know, complex narratives on stage. But I must say, though, the thing that really struck me about particularly the first half was that we were all sitting on the edge of your seat where, you know, big kids or little kids, because
I think this adaptation really works well. It really pulls together the story. From the get-go, you're just fascinated by these characters and, you know, what adventure they're going to have. And I think that's really a testament to the adaptation there, because actually I was really interested in this piece from actually coming to it quite cold and not knowing the story at all. So I think that's also something impressive as well. And I agree too, the cast were excellent. And you know, particularly, what was it, Alistair Toovey, who, you know, holds it together as the dreamer central character. And I think, you know, it was really a nice Christmas story. And having caught Mother Goose at Wilton's Music Hall last year, which was a traditional panto, it was really nice to see that they do another Christmassy feeling story, but, you know, something different this year. So I think definitely this is on my favourite of Christmas shows now to see.
We're now going to talk about The Woman in White at the Charing Cross Theatre. This is Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical, with music by Andrew Lloyd Webber, lyrics by David Zippel, and the book by Charlotte Jones. It is directed by Tom Sutherland, with music by Cressida Carey, and a set by Morgan Large. Paul, tell me more about this musical and what you thought of it.
The Woman in White is actually, I believe it's its first revival since it was first staged in the West End just over 10 years ago now. And in this version, but directed by Tom Sutherland, it's much more pared back. So the intention is that you will focus on the cast and the story and the performances and, you know, the interplay. And I think they're now alluding to the fact that it's less of a spectacular musical and more of a chamber musical, which is what its original intention was. Although, having seen a few Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals, you don't get the sense that he writes for the small stage. He really does want things to be big, intensive, and gothic. And in a way, this is what The Woman in White is really about, because it is based, I believe, on a gothic novel from the Victorian period. So I didn't know the story, so I came in cold to this. But I think what strikes you about this particular production is it's got an incredible cast. It actually sounds great, and it doesn't look too bad either in the Charing Cross Theatre. But the story just doesn't make any sense. And there's some curious choices in the adaptation that probably, depending on whether you accept them or not, will probably determine whether you actually like this piece or love it. And I think most people seem to be going for the like a bit rather than love it. And yet essentially the story is two young bored women who are in the country get an artist to come in and help them draw. And the artist, on his way in to their place, sees a ghostly woman on their way who talks about an impending peril. And Walter, who's the artist, falls in love with, but the girl that he falls in love with, Laura, she's engaged to marry this gentleman called Sir Percival Glyde, because it was her father's dying wish. And so she then goes off to become Lady Glyde. And there's an awful lot of singing, really, about Lady Glyde, which even in 2004, you would have thought, when this production first came out, that people might have thought it had double meanings, because it does sound like it's a lubricant. And it does tend to distract. And I think one of the problems in this piece is that a lot of the choices they've made in this adaptation just don't seem to make much sense. They've kept in this very convoluted story, and the lyrics tend to, you know, emphasize this outrage and injustice, but without actually developing the characters in any sense of the way. And I think that's what you kind of actually feel like halfway through this piece. Do you actually care that Lady Glyde is getting beaten up by Sir Percival Glyde and he's going to take her money? Because actually, you've not really invested much time into actually understanding the characters. I think the other point with Andrew Lloyd Webber's score, you know, occasionally it's lush and goes for the big romantic, you know, sounds that he's known for. He does tend to overdo the motifs around the Victorian stuffiness of the period, which makes it sound almost like you're at evensong at church, rather than actually, you know, watching a musical, and with these slow musical rises and falls. But, you know, there's occasional flashes of brilliance. And I think what really makes this piece is the cast that's assembled for it. There's a wonderful trio early on in the piece where the cast, which is played by Carolyn Maitland, Anna O'Byrne, and Ashley Stilburn, manage to sing about perspectives, and they're getting to know each other. And it's actually quite a sublime piece of musical making. Also, Stilburn in the second half has a terrific emotional song about Evermore Without You, which is probably the most well-known song from this piece. He really nails that in terms of, you know, the getting the emotional impact and gravitas across. And it just reminds you that, you know, definitely Stillburn himself is probably one that will go on to much bigger and better things. Playing the CAD, Sir Percival Glyde, is Chris Peluso, and it's actually quite nice to see him play this nasty character. And you know he's nasty because he has facial hair, so that's about as in depth as the character gets. And his sidekick, Greg Castiglione, as Count Fosco, is comic relief in the piece. And, you know, he does well with his song about you can get away with anything. But I think ultimately...
He has removable facial hair, which is even more dastardly.
Yes, that's actually quite a clever theatrical trick, isn't it, John? But, you know, I think as much as I like the production, I love the cast in it. This story and this musical, you know, still is problematic. And part of the problem is you don't care about these characters. The other part is the curious adaptation and the relentless lyrics referring to Lady Glyde, which serves as an unintended distraction and amusement. But ultimately, if you're into seeing musical theatre stars that will of the future, you know, it might be well worth seeing. But as a piece of musical theatre itself, I'm not so sure. John, what did you think?
I agree with you a great deal that the cast is the reason for going to this, and the enjoyment of hearing excellent male and female voices like Ashley Stillburn, Chris Peluso, Carolyn Maitland and Anna O'Byrne. They are four of the very best you could assemble into a cast for a show. And it is just unfortunate that between them and the generous staging that this production has been given is that it just doesn't emerge as a perfect piece of musical theatre for a contemporary audience. That's the thing I also want to say, is that the trouble with The Woman in White is that if you dissect all the elements that Andrew Lloyd Webber fused into the show, they're all perfectly fine. It's just his stirring up of the recipe that spoils it. You could also add that Tom Sutherland's production flatters the source material as generously as you possibly could with this rich and elaborate and elegant staging, and also some very lush orchestration. At times it sounds as if they've got the London Philharmonic at the back of the stage instead of just a 10-piece pit band. So he's also managed, yet again, I don't know quite how he does it, but he manages to make the tunnel-shaped Charing Cross Theatre look like a big stage. It really does feel, certainly if you're in the front half of the auditorium, it feels engrossing and enveloping and very well put together, and you do feel the sense of time and place. And the voices and the sound system are first rate, and you get every word with clarity, which is, again, quite rare in a fringe venue. And the acting and the staging steer well clear of Victorian melodrama. It's a great cast. It's a great staging, but it's not enough. See, Wilkie Collins's detective story is written in 1859, when it was really considered groundbreaking, and it's admirably creepy, but it's not refreshed by this skin graft Lloyd Webber has applied to it of overwrought ballads, banal recitatives, and raging anthems that have so many echoes from his own back catalogue. I mean, you can hear bits of Phantom, you can hear bits of Whistle Down the Wind, you can hear bits of Sunset Boulevard, and yet he still hasn't produced a single distinguished number that survived outside this musical. At times to me, the score sounded like anthem after anthem. It sounded like a Josh Groban album. Well, that's maybe unkind to Mr. Groban, because his songs at least have identifiable beginnings and ends, and some of these just appear from nowhere and disappear as easily. Of course, audience tastes change. What ran for a year and a half from 2004 can look past its sell-by date when resurrected in 2017. But even in 2004, this wasn't a great show. It had a lot of problems. It had a series of projections and atmospherics that made the audience sick and dizzy. And so it's fortunate that this version has been stripped of that. You know, we've had holograms at Charing Cross Theatre with Dusty, and I think everybody's learned that lesson not to do it again. I think it's enough to say that fans of the musical theatre genre will admire the technique and the virtuosity of these performances. But you can't hold this old-fashioned composition up against Everybody's Talking About Jamie or An American in Paris and say it's remotely in the same class. So I think Lloyd Webber needs to park this one and not try to revive it in this form in the near future.
Yes, it's more of a curiosity, isn't it? For those that have, you know, missed it the first time round or were fearful of the projections making them sick, this is probably as good as it gets with this production, particularly with the cast.
It made the cast sick as well.
Michael Crawford, because he wore a fat suit, which basically wrecked his water balance or something like that.
He fainted, I think, yeah. Mm.
And then Michael Ball took it over.
I'm now going to talk about Misalliance at the Orange Tree Theatre. This is George Bernard Shaw's 1910 play, directed here by Paul Miller, the artistic director of the Orange Tree Theatre, with it designed by Laura Hopkins. It stars Pip Donaghy as Tarleton, a rich haberdasher who's living out in Hindhead, Tom Hanson as his son Johnny, Rhys Isaac Jones as Bentley Summerhayes, a young man who is affianced to Hypatia, the daughter of the house, played by Marley Sue. We have Gabriel Lloyd as Mrs. Tarleton, Simon Shepherd as Lord Summerhayes, Lara Rossi as Lena, Jordan Misford as Julius, and Luke Thallion as Joey. We are in Hindhead, Surrey. It is a summer afternoon. It is supposed to be a conservatory, although you can't really depict that at the Orange Tree Theatre because it's in the round. And Hypatia Tarleton is rather uneasily engaged to Bentley Summerhayes. He's a bit of a screaming, well, I suppose you could call him a screaming queen. I don't really think that's something that George Bernard Shaw perhaps would have thought of. He seems to be rather hypersensitive and does eek and scream an awful lot. He doesn't seem an entirely suitable husband for Hypatia, although she perhaps is rather more interested in someone else, although she does like the idea of his title, especially that she's basically a haberdasher's or a draper's daughter, so she's looking to go up in the world, and he is a very advantageous husband, although I'm not sure that she likes him. It's interesting that this is not the only character I've seen of George Bernard Shaw's in Bentley Summerhayes, who's a bit, shall we say, a little bit fey. Certainly we have in St. Joan, you have the character of the Dauphin, who's a bit sensitive and a bit like this. We kind of learn that Mr. Tarleton's a bit of a, well, shall we say, a man about the ladies, which of course has different echoes these days. And he's not the only one. Lord Summerhayes, Bentley's father, he's an experienced diplomat, and he has sort of made love, as it were, to Hypatia. And she seems to be a little bit torn, although she enjoys having the power over him. One of the people that young Bentley fears most is Hypatia's brother Jack, who's a bit of a bully, really, and is very straight-laced. One of the reasons this play has always interested me is that when I was young, if you ever wanted to satirise the drawing room comedies of the, well, from any time between the 20s and the 50s, and the kind of comedy drawing room comedies that were replaced by kitchen sink dramas or kitchen sink plays, you would always have a young man coming in through the windows of a conservatory or through the French windows, clutching a tennis racket and saying, "Anyone for tennis?" And nobody quite knows where this comes from. And the closest person who actually ever said it seriously or semi-seriously, because obviously the Misalliance isn't serious, is a line in Misalliance where somebody says, "Is anyone actually going to want to play tennis?" Which isn't exactly the same line that we are used to in all the parodies. And it's just something that seems to have cropped up. Other people attribute it to Humphrey Bogart in The Petrified Forest, which is an interesting ad lib. But he based it on some of his early theatre experiences, whether watching or appearing in them, where there would be somebody popping through the French windows asking people to play tennis. And it does seem to have come from Misalliance, although it's not a major thing in this. And I'm pretty sure, although tennis is mentioned, you don't feel the line in the way that it was done in the satires of this kind of play. And this, and of course Misalliance, being a George Bernard Shaw play, is an awful lot about talking. It isn't a sort of light drawing room comedy. Into this sort of rather idyllic place, a plane literally crashes, and it's an aeronaut who wants to get his passenger hours up, and his passenger is a Polish acrobat called Lena Szczepanowska, and she outcompetes Hypatia, who's this appalling flirt, because pretty much all of the men in the building more or less propose to her almost immediately. They're all very struck by her good looks and her forthright manner. She's, as an acrobat, is somebody who lives for danger, having to do a dangerous thing every day, and she lives a very independent life, and she's very used to people falling in love with her. And she forms a firm friendship with the first person in the house to propose to her, which is Mr. Tarleton, and she starts talking to him as a pal. She has, of course, met Lord Summerhayes before, because he proposed to her in Europe when she was performing. And yeah, pretty much by the end of it, almost all the men have proposed to her, and she's sort of this breath of fresh air and used as this sort of person who questions the whole setup of England and the all the Englishness, which obviously Shaw wants to do. Also in this setup is a young man, a young bank clerk, who wishes to take his revenge against Tarleton because Tarleton had his mother dismissed after she got pregnant. There is a possibility, it's sort of intimated, that Tarleton may have been the person who got her pregnant, or him having a fling with her that got her fired, although it's never quite cleared up, but it implies that the young man might just be Tarleton's son. So that comes into the mix, and you have a Turkish bath cupboard that you haven't seen, for the sort of thing you haven't seen for years, which is where your head just sticks out of this rather large cupboard and you sit in there and steam gently, and he hides in that with a gun and comes out and tries to shoot people, but he's never really going to shoot anybody, and they decide not to harm him. Obviously it's a very talky play. You get an awful lot of how they deal with Tarleton's behaviour, how they deal with the vagaries of almost this endless summer, this Edwardian peacefulness that seems never to end, where Britain is just rich and powerful and everything's right with the world, but George Bernard Shaw is constantly trying to dig into it and dig into what's right and wrong about England, and he talks in terms of England rather than Britain. It's a lot of fun. It's very well done, this production. Paul Miller has got quite a good touch with his George Bernard Shaw adaptations. This is very much set in period, although maybe 1920s rather than the 1910s in terms of period. But Paul Miller has done things like The Philanderer last year, or even earlier this year, and also Widower's Houses in 2016. He does seem to have a very good touch with George Bernard Shaw, and it's interesting that George Bernard Shaw has, rather like Terence Rattigan did a few years ago, George Bernard Shaw has sort of cropped up, and people are discovering that if they cut him right, because he is a bit verbose and you do need to cut him, but if they cut him right and they have good direction, you can make a very good production out of a George Bernard Shaw play, and people really seem to enjoy them. I mean, we've had a pretty good St. Joan. We've had some very good Major Barbaras in the past few years. So I think that, keep going with George Bernard Shaw's, and hopefully the Orange Tree will produce lots more, and hopefully we'll see a lot more in the future.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azeta named London Theatre Podcast page at Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.